It's Philosophy Talk.
We are encouraging our readers, you, to read a banned book this week.
Is removing controversial books from school libraries the same as banning them?
Who decides what books count as controversial?
Well, a Virginia woman is doing all she can to remove 6 books from Virginia Beach schools, including Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, which this fool admits she hasn't read.
Does it really matter if I can't get a book from my school's library if I can have it delivered to my house tomorrow?
There's often a run on these banned books when controversy leads to curiosity. Ever since Wentzville schools removed The Bluest Eye from their shelves, some local bookstores tell us they've had a hard time keeping copies on their shelves because of the high demand.
Is banning a book the last step before burning it?
It's our annual summer reading list.
The Banned Books Edition.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you via the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today's episode is generously sponsored by the Stanford Division of Literatures, Cultures, and Languages. It's our annual summer reading special, the Banned Books Edition.
The American Library Association says that last year, 1,597 books were challenged or removed from libraries, schools, and universities. Compare that to just 273 from 2 years ago. It's a record high.
Yeah, and most of the challenged or removed books deal with themes relating to race or to sexuality and gender. And challenges actually come from both the right and the left.
Just to be clear, we're not talking about literal bans here. I mean, it's not a crime to own one of these books, and if one of them has been removed from your school library, you could probably order it up, get it delivered to your house tomorrow.
Right. And when schools remove books from the curriculum, they're not necessarily trying to ban anything. Sometimes students just want access to more contemporary books, books they think do a better job reflecting their realities.
So to get us started, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to talk to some of those students. She files this report.
If you want to feel good about the state of America's education system, stay away from YouTube videos of school board meetings about book banning.
I'm sure we've got hundreds of people out there that would like to see those books before we burn them.
In this one from Virginia, school board members appeared really passionate about the power and sway of literature.
Just so we can identify within our community that we are eradicating this bad stuff.
This isn't the 1940s or 50s. This was 2021. The school board had directed staff to begin removing, quote, sexually explicit books from library shelves. And it's not just happening in a small community in Virginia. More books are being banned in the U.S. than ever before. Here's a TV ad from the 2021 Virginia governor's race.
As a parent, it's tough to catch everything. So when my son showed me his reading assignment, my heart sunk. It was some of the most explicit material you can imagine. I met with lawmakers. They couldn't believe what I was showing them.
The mother in this ad is talking about Toni Morrison's Beloved, a book assigned in her son's AP English literature class. Many of the books parents wanted banned featured LGBTQ themes or characters, or dealt with racism. What was happening in Burbank, California in 2020 was different. The students involved in that effort just wanted a more equitable and up-to-date curriculum.
We were just saying that our curriculum needed a shift and that to update it so that our curriculum reflects the world that we live in today.
Destiny Helliger is a student at the Burbank Unified School District. She said this push to reshape the curriculum started with Romeo and Juliet. This was during a time when people in the district were worried about suicides.
So we decided to put a pause on Romeo and Juliet. Later on, Romeo and Juliet came back, and some families of color in our district decided that a lot of the books that contained the N-word could have that same effect on students of color, and that these books were negatively impacting the mental health of students. So maybe we should just take a pause to reevaluate them.
Some people were really upset that the superintendent was looking to take books out of the curriculum, like Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. To Kill a Mockingbird, and Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
It was just tense. It was incredibly tense, and there was a lot of people who didn't want to give up what they thought.
That's Finn Kroll, another student at the school. He says teachers aren't always equipped or trained to explain why certain words are harmful. Finn is often the only transgender person in the room. He's had to educate classmates about a homophobic slur during a discussion on Catcher in the Rye.
The first time I read about a trans person in a classroom wasn't even from a school curriculum. It was from my own research, and the fact that I was 14 before I even heard the word transgender is disappointing. Because that is who I am and who I always will be and who I am proud to be. And that should have been reflected in our curriculum.
The school district did end up taking certain classics out of the curriculum, but students also wanted the district to add newer, more contemporary books. Destiny and Finn say so far they're disappointed.
I was able to start the Destiny Education Project because I wanted to start putting some more action to where I wasn't seeing action.
The Destiny Education Project is a BIPOC-led organization that aims to improve the American school system. She also started a peer-to-peer reading group.
I think my first experience there, it made me really emotional because I had never read a book in elementary school where there was a Black character in it. And then I was reading this book called I Am Every Good Thing, where the main character is a young Black boy. And I saw one of the students and he just like gasped and he was like, oh my God, that character looks just like me.
As for Finn, he recommends the book Both Sides Now, about a transgender boy on the debate team who discovers that some things, like who you are and who you love, are not up for debate. And yet, here we are. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks very much, Holly, for that report from the front lines. You know, I gotta say, Ray, Toni Morrison's one of my favorite authors. I teach her every single year, and I just find it astonishing to hear a parent of Virginia say, I don't want my son reading Beloved.
Yeah, you know, some parents didn't just complain. In 2020, a school board in California voted to actually ban another one of Toni Morrison's novels, The Bluest Eye. And the same thing happened this year in Wentzville, Missouri. The Bluest Eye got pulled from the library.
I remember that. I mean, okay, they relented after an outcry, but still, why on earth did they want to ban in the first place?
Well, I bet our first guest will have some thoughts about that. Paula Moya is professor of English at Stanford University and the author of The Social Imperative, which is a book about Toni Morrison, among other authors. So we asked her why she thinks that school boards want to ban The Bluest Eye.
What's interesting is often the ostensible reason is because it treats some, you know, situations that are really troubling, like child sexual abuse. But I actually think that there's much more animus, if you will, toward the racial politics of her books and how pointed she is about talking about the history of slavery in our country, the history of racialized violence in our country. And so I can imagine that if I held some of that ideology myself, I wouldn't really want my children reading it because it might teach them something different than what I believed.
Yeah, I mean, she's incredible. I mean, she's incredible at everything, but among other things, at telling the bleak history of America's racial past. She does in incredible ways, well, throughout her novels, but including in Mercy, which is a novel that you really turned me on to, Paula. You've written brilliantly about it, and that's a novel that takes us back to a moment in sort of pre-American history when slavery is just about to be racialized. And you can imagine someone of the current, let's not have our children learn anything that might upset their delicate sensibilities framework, thinking, well, gee, I don't want my child to learn about the truth of American history. Do you think that's what's underlying this?
I do. And I get some of that idea from the really intense reaction, for instance, to the 1619 project that the New York Times published. Now, you know, I have my own issues with every version of history, because oftentimes any version of history tends to be very partial or very targeted to a specific group. So I'm not saying that that was perfect, but it was really important for setting some of the record straight about, you know, what made our early America, you know, even before it was America. So, but there was such an intense reaction to that project that it makes me realize that some people just don't want to hear about prehistory and slavery here in the United States.
Yeah, so one thing I think is like really powerful in The Bluest Eye is this figure of Dick and Jane. These are like ideal, like kind of implicitly white American family characters that she's just kind of taking apart.
Yes.
Like the characters in the novel who are more realistic than Dick and Jane don't really live up to this ideal and can't.
Well, you know, one of the really interesting things is that Toni Morrison starts out The Bluest Eye with a kind of Dick and Jane narrative. And so, you know, those of us of, say, my generation grew up with these readers that introduced us to the characters of Dick and Jane, who were these prototypically white American, you know, middle class, you know, mother, father, brother, sister, dog, cat kind of world. And she starts out with a conventional orthographic, you know, story of Dick and Jane and everybody being very happy and working out very well. And then in the next one, it's the same words, the same story, but with all the punctuation removed. And then in the next iteration, it's the same story, the same words, but with all the spaces and punctuation removed, so that it becomes very frantic, even in the visual aspect of looking at the Dick and Jane story. So it has this emotional impact on the reader that defamiliarizes that Dick and Jane story for us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, she's always doing these incredible things with the second half of Beloved. It's also just a brilliant tour de force of literary fireworks, but not just, of course, for their own sake, not just for fun, not just for aesthetic power, but they really hit you right in the gut.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's often this idea that what we're so familiar with that we don't question it, we don't ask about it, we don't see it as strange. And so she has this way in her writing of making what seems or ought to be familiar to us strange that makes us then question it. So starting out right at the very beginning of that novel to make strange or to defamiliarize the kind of prototypical happy white middle-class family makes us then shift our thinking or our perception a little bit into seeing the story that she's about to tell us a little bit differently.
Do you think that there is an alternative vision in there of a way things could be good, or is just like telling the truth about ways things that are bad? Like, is that the project, or is it like different in different novels?
I think it's probably not different in the different novels, even though the way it manifests is very different. I think those two projects go together. So in the same way that we need to actually understand our real history in order to make a better future, I think Toni Morrison believes that we have to actually understand how people are to each other, how they act, how they interact, how they treat each other, in order to understand how we might be able to treat each other in a better. So, you know, one thing she does in The Bluest Eye, as in other novels, is give us a tremendous amount of context about the characters, you know, which we can see as people, about how they came up and why they have the attitudes they do and why they treat each other the way they do, in order to understand how, you know, it might have gone differently and they might be able to do it differently. So I think those projects go together. She's not trying to make this neutral for us, and she wants to make us work. So I think right. You're absolutely right about that.
So I have a question about how this relates to sort of book banning. And I feel a little bit silly even giving voice to this objection because I don't believe it. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine somebody saying, look, it's all fine and good to reflect on the horrors of slavery, but like, A lot of Morrison's novels are pretty graphic and it's really intense. And is it too intense for high school kids to handle? Like, should we shelter them?
Well, I guess I just want to give a little bit more credit to high school age children or young people, I'll say. One thing that I have to say about Morrison, and I suspect you'll agree with me, is that she's an extraordinarily talented writer. You know, she's really able to convey ordinary and extraordinary experiences of human lives with a talent, you know, of using figural, you know, say metaphorical language that really is kind of unsurpassed. And I think one other thing I would say, Ray, is that Morrison is never voyeuristic. You know, she doesn't allow the reader to get pleasure in this violence. She portrays it very effectively, often using metaphors, but it is always with a framework that, you know, reminds us of that context that brought the person to that violence or to that predation that, you know, makes us really think about, you know, how we maybe got there.
Yeah, and to my mind, that's exactly why high school kids should be reading Morrison. I mean, I'm not talking about, obviously, you know, very young kids, yes, who are, right? But, you know, towards the end of high school, 16, 17 years old, these are fantastic books, not just as an entry into history and politics and really important questions that are still very much alive today, but also for just stretching your mind. I mean, these are tour de force novels that show you what a novel can be. Yes. And they're also, they're political ruminations, they're philosophical ruminations. There's all this stuff in A Mercy about the problem of suffering. Why does, if there's a benevolent God, why is there so much suffering? Implicitly including slavery, of course. Yes. And Morris is constantly thinking philosophically and raising the philosophical questions. What better thing for a 17-year-old to read?
Exactly. And I think, you know, her books are deeply ethical. You know, they ask you to think about the choices that you're making and to think about how you want to take something that happened to you in the past into the future or not. So I think it's right at that age, you know, 16 or 17, where you're kind of learning how to be a person, you know, that you have to learn how to make choices. And, you know, that all choices are not the same. All choices are not equal. And so I think reading Morrison's books and the way that she gives us appropriate context for how people come to be who they are, that she is able to, in a sense, instruct us and teach us how to be better people in the world.
Couldn't agree more, Paula. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much, Josh. I was glad to be here.
Paula Moya from Stanford University on why Toni Morrison should be on our reading lists all year round. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and today it's our annual summer reading special, the Banned Books Edition.
Coming up, if a Nobel Prize-winning author can be banned for supposedly inappropriate content, what about other books full of murder, adultery, and sexual immorality, like the Bible? And what happens when suppressing controversial books and ideas collides with freedom of speech in schools and universities?
Banning books in the classroom and beyond, plus other recommendations for controversial summer reading when Philosophy Talk continues.
My name's Tim Smith, and the book that I'm nominating is Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak. It was banned for about 20 years, a little bit more. At the time, anybody who criticized Stalin could be put to death or sent to Siberia. It has that in it. It has criticism of Marxism in short little paragraphs here and there by different characters. It criticizes collectivization, which is what was going on in the Ukraine that created the Russian-speaking population there. They collectivized the agriculture there and sent out some of the Ukrainian farmers. You know, reading this book, you really see the chaos. Nikita Khrushchev, you know, he's the one who took over after Stalin, and that he himself was deposed or, you know, left power. And then he actually read the book. And when he read the book, he regretted, supposedly, banning it. So it's not a great book. It's not, character development is kind of off. The morality is a little off, but it's the chaos of the times and the pictures and the little vignettes in it that really bring it home.
This is Paul calling from Berkeley. And the book I want to suggest is called How the World Really Works. The author is Vaclav Smil. He discusses the basics of how our modern world civilization is held together by a relatively few major components. And he describes how these interact with climate change and also with the human population. And I have been fascinated by the population question ever since I was a kid, which is a long time ago. And there seemed to be this tendency on everybody's part to think it just doesn't matter. But this viewpoint ignores the fact that there is some limit to the population somewhere. So the philosophical question would be, you know, what's our goal? Do we want to have, you know, as many human souls as possible, all standing on one another's heads? or do we want to keep some semblance of Earth, you know, for us to enjoy?
My name is Matthew. I'm from California. I'm recommending Roger Scruton's Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands. Scruton himself, of course, was a bit of an outsider. And in this particular book, he takes aim a lot of what would now be considered sacred cows in the world of philosophy and social sciences. However, it's not mere criticism in the sense that he's responding and that he directly analyzes the text and what these authors said and his reaction to what they said. And I think that's important these days because a lot of assumptions are being pushed and a lot is changing in academia. And while some may see this book as controversial, and I myself don't agree with everything Scruton says, I would say that this is certainly worth reading and worth thinking about, especially if you come from a background where people like Foucault or Habermas or Judith Butler are considered prime modern philosophers. Hearing what Scruton has to say is relevant and important.
Thanks very much to our listeners for suggesting those banned or controversial books to read this summer. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and it's our annual summer reading show, the Banned Books Edition, generously sponsored by the Stanford Division of Literatures, Cultures, and Languages.
So it's presumably wrong to ban a book for political reasons, but what about academic reasons? What if a book's full of misinformation and terrible arguments? Does free speech demand that we pay attention to it?
Jennifer Ruth is professor of film at Portland State University, and Michael Berube is professor of English at Penn State University. Their new book is titled It's Not Free Speech: Race, Democracy, and the Future of Academic Freedom. They argue that free speech and academic freedom are two very different things.
Academic freedom technically is the protections for research, teaching, and extramural, by which we mean like social media speech, intramural, by which we mean speaking within the organization, so faculty speaking to administrators about the organization of the university, protections for that kind of work. And that's a collective, whereas free speech, First Amendment, is very much an individual-based right. Academic freedom is a collectively regulated and governed right. And the sort of foundational organization, American Association of University Professors, they organized because faculty were getting fired by administrators whose wives didn't like something that a professor said, and all kinds of crazy reasons that had nothing to do with whether the professor's work was intellectually legitimate or not. And so professors organized. John Dewey was part of the original organization, and they said, well, we have to come up with some principles and guidelines for academic freedom that protect faculty from arbitrary influence from non-experts. So what that means, though, the corollary for that, though, is that experts do have to police one another. And that's where academic freedom is different from free speech, perhaps. Free speech, your opinion is as good as a fact.
So like what would be an example of something that is protected by my right to free speech but isn't protected by academic freedom?
Phrenology has much to teach us. and we'll bring calipers to prove it. And that's actually an example from the book. I mean, again, if we were talking maybe 100, 120 years ago, phrenology was still considered sort of the cutting edge of criminology. Cesare Lombroso made an entire career out of it. No responsible person should be promoting phrenology today. But if you want to do it on a street corner, go to, you know, and good luck.
So phrenology is unlikely to come up, right, in classrooms. But right. What about various interesting views about COVID-19? I mean, we had a bunch of those coming out of various corners of Stanford University and, of course, other universities. There was a Stanford historian who said, as a matter of science, the governors are wrong, because I guess historians know better about science. And, you know, we had an economist telling us the number of deaths in the United States would be 5,000. And we had someone who became a member of the Trump administration saying masks don't work.
That's right.
What should happen in a case like that? I mean, these are claims that have been roundly debunked by the vast consensus of specialists. What should happen?
So what happened with Scott Atlas, I think, is very instructive, in that the Faculty Senate, that Stanford faculty, you know, put together a petition, and then they brought it to Senate, and they said, why should, you know, Stanford has an important reputation for helping provide information that's useful for democracy. If we have someone who the vast majority of his peers would say is peddling misinformation, how do we hold that person accountable? And it's extremely hard. And that's partly why we wrote the book, because we're arguing that some of the older traditional ways of capturing someone who is sort of destructively peddling misinformation in the, under the guise of academic authority would have been weeded out. We don't have a lot of those protections anymore for two reasons. One is that we've vastly gone down the road of hiring off the tenure track, which means that all the whole sort of vetting procedures where your peers evaluate your work and decide whether or not you deserve tenure, which is what gives you academic freedom, essentially. Many, many faculty don't go through that process. And then, of course, there are faculty who have tenure who are nonetheless spreading misinformation that a university and a whole discipline or field may feel is very, very destructive and problematic. So that's why we came up with the idea of an academic freedom committee, where people could return to the original sort of, we have to police one another in order to maintain the kind of high levels of job security that tenure provides. It comes with a responsibility to be fact-checking one another, essentially.
Yeah. In fact, we have an extended rant. We condensed it for an essay in the New Republic 2 months ago. But one of our chapters opens up by going after a really regrettable 1994 statement put out by the AAUP, by the American Association of University Professors. And it was a response to speech codes. It was a response to the so-called political correctness scare of the early 90s. There's one passage in there that says, you know, a university charts a perilous path if it starts distinguishing high value from low value speech. And then there's another really horrible line. Indeed, by proscribing any ideas, a university sets an example that profoundly disturbs its academic mission. And Jennifer and I is like, no, actually, one of the things we're supposed to do is proscribe some ideas. So we actually name a bunch of people in the book. And even though Jennifer and I swear that we are not going to adjudicate every case, we don't even know if these people should be fired or disciplined or what. We think that should be left to their peers. But we actually come up with a number of, we think, fairly difficult cases where people are calling into question their own professional fitness to teach.
So I have a question about the race science example, actually, because I can think of multiple things that are wrong with race science, and I'm not sure which of them are relevant. So one that seems like it definitely ought to be relevant is that race science isn't true. Like, we have good evidence that it's not true. Another one is that it's bigoted. It's like politically bad. Another one that a lot of people sort of mention is that it's offensive. And another one is that it's potentially harmful. And those seem like separate features. Which of them are relevant? Which of them are most relevant to whether
the
it's
first? Yeah, no, we make a point of not going anywhere near the second, third, and fourth rationales. I mean, we believe it is bigoted, it is harmful, but we're not going to make that case because it allows someone like a law professor at Penn, University of Penn, when Amy Wax was told that her really crazy versions of race science as applied to immigration, when she was told that this was hurtful and damaging, she was like, yeah, the truth hurts. Suck it up, buttercup. You're leaving people, you're giving these trolls a slam dunk answer by going right to the harm question. Now, having said that, one of the founding texts of critical race theory in the early 90s was called Words That Wound. And a lot of argument from minority scholars was that these kinds of arguments, these kinds of slurs are profoundly damaging. We don't doubt that they are. We're not in a really great position as white people to make that case, sort of to ventriloquize it. We think the really important argument to be made with academic freedom is that these various offshoots of race science have no intellectual legitimacy whatsoever and should be moved over to the phrenology side of the table.
So, Michael, I answered the question really clearly in terms of it's a question of fitness. It's not a question of harm or necessarily even a question of whether it's destructive of the democracy that academic freedom is supposed to ultimately be in service of. But this question of unfitness is what's key, because there's a surge to ban history of America, the 1619 Project, etc., because it makes us uncomfortable or it's a divisive concept. And that's fundamentally wrong. And fundamentally, they're using free speech to attack academic freedom, you might say. It's not so much that Nicole Hannah-Jones should have her free speech rights to teach about 1619 at Howard if she wants. It's her academic freedom to do so, because this is stuff that's been vetted by her peers. She has prizes for this work. So they're attacking academic freedom when they go after our history.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual summer reading special. And we're talking to Jennifer Ruth and Michael Berube, co-authors of It's Not Free Speech, Race, Democracy, and the Future of Academic Freedom.
So I have a question in a slightly different direction about which speech is protected by academic freedom. You said at the beginning, I can go stand on a street corner and yell about whatever nonsense I want, and that's not a matter of academic freedom. But when I'm in the classroom, it's protected by academic freedom. What if I'm like posting on my blog, like under my professor identity?
We have a whole chapter on that for those who really want to get into the weeds, because it's incredibly complicated. If I can boil it down to a single, very long bumper sticker, it would go like this. When you're speaking in social media, you have more protection for saying things about which you know nothing than about speaking from your area of expertise. So in other words, if I want to mouth off about, I don't know what, whatever sports thing, or if I want to actually suggest that the movie Apollo 18 was not in fact fiction, it was a documentary and people are covering it up, okay, I'm a nut, but I have no expertise in this area, I'm just mouthing off. If I start doing things, I work, among other things, in disability studies. If I start going back and saying, you know, there were certain advantages to involuntary sterilization, of the so-called feeble-minded, now I'm calling into question my fitness to teach anything, let alone disability studies. So the relationship of extramural speech, speech in social media, speech on a street corner, to academic freedom is really, really complicated. We have, in this country, made it that way because we've decided to include extramural speech as part of academic freedom. Some traditions do not. Most European traditions do not. They leave extramural speech to protection or lack of protection by the state. We decided that it's part of the armature of academic freedom to give academics as much latitude as possible, even when they're not in the classroom. And that's really where most of your controversies have come from in the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very helpful way of thinking about what's okay and what's not okay in this extramural speech, in this speech outside of school, speech on your blog, on Twitter, on Facebook, or something like that. You know, it's not just false, it's not just dangerous, but it shows you shouldn't be allowed in the classroom. You don't have what it takes. You don't have the chops, right? You've lost your ability to separate the true from the false. But there's another really interesting sort of aspect of the world of social media, which is that it really seems to be disproving this old notion I think we all get from John Stuart Mill, who has a lot to be said for him, but really the best discourse environment is one in which everyone gets a voice. And if you just, you know, it's free market, right? Just let everyone speak and the good information will drown out the bad. And I think we're all learning that Mill's wrong and Swift is right, that falsehood flies and truth comes limping after it. Is that about where the two of you are as well?
Yes.
We take Justice Brandeis's famous line, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And I'm like, well, Ulrich Baer has a really interesting argument in his book, What Snowflakes Get Right, that between 1977 in Skokie, Illinois, and 2017 in Charlottesville, Virginia, maybe tolerating and defending Nazis didn't make them go away. And maybe sunlight is good for Nazis because it makes them grow. And maybe bleach, we think, would be a better disinfectant. So we don't actually go so far as to call for sort of a hate speech exception to the First Amendment. We do think the First Amendment has been vastly overextended by the Roberts Court in the last 10, 12 years, but we're actually not legal experts. We did not stay in Holiday Inn Express last night, and we only learned the term First Amendment Lochnerism in the course of writing this book from the legal theorist Tim Wu. But we're at least willing to say, if you're not alarmed by the complete proliferation of inexpert speech in a world in which people get their medical advice from Joe Rogan, you have not been paying attention.
So one thing I really like about your approach is the way that it sets aside considerations like, is this speech gonna hurt somebody's feelings, for considerations of, is this speech actually true?
And another thing that I like is that it's scrupulously fair, right? So you're not taking sides. This isn't a book that says, right-wing faculty are saying things we don't like and they should be disciplined. And it's also not saying left-wing faculty are saying things we don't like and they should be disciplined. It's saying, look, there's actually a variety of different cases. And, you know, one of the main purposes of the First Amendment is expressive. It allows people to speak their mind. But one of the main values of academic freedom is epistemic. It helps us get the truth. That's what we want at universities. So how do we get the train back on the rails? How do we make sure that folks aren't just polluting the discourse environment, aren't just weaponizing their status in order to spread misinformation? How do we get universities to take this more seriously?
That's a really good question in terms of, because there's no question of the distinction between academic freedom and free speech. It actually seems to be sort of infecting the university itself in terms of incapacitating faculty to feel like we can judge one another, but that's in fact what we are here to do in large part. So in academic, I think your point that what you like about the book is that we're not saying, you know, this is harmful, so you can't do it. This is, you know, we're not just sort of taking whole categories and saying, you can talk about this, you can't talk about that. But we're talking about who gets to judge, right? It shouldn't be a provost or a president who's risk averse. It shouldn't be a politician who's trying, an attorney general who wants to ban CRT because he's primarily reading Chris Rufo as his primary source. Those aren't the people who should judge. It should be peers within a discipline or adjacent fields that are in the same kinds of conversations as the person who's being judged. So who's being judged and how you do it, the deliberative process, that could go a long way towards helping put some guardrails in at a moment where we really need them.
So Jennifer, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Jennifer Ruth and Michael Berube, co-authors of It's Not Free Speech, Race, Democracy, and the Future of Academic Freedom, a book we've definitely got on our summer reading list.
Coming up, summer book suggestions from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, plus the case for banning the Bible, when Philosophy Talk's banned book summer reading special continues. You're listening to Philosophy Talk's annual summer reading list, the Banned Books Edition, generously sponsored by the Stanford Division of Literatures, Cultures, and Languages. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're thinking about thoughtful and controversial books that some people say other people shouldn't read.
Over in Florida, they just passed a bill allowing parents to challenge books taught in schools, anything with material some parent happens to find disturbing.
Our next guest, Florida activist Chaz Stevens, has a not entirely tongue-in-cheek response. Let's ban the Bible.
Ban the Bible?
Well, yeah. Think about it. People want to ban Mouse, the graphic novel about the Holocaust, because it's got cartoon animals that briefly are depicted without clothes. So if that's your standard, why not the Bible? It's full of sex and violence. There's even an episode where an innocent woman is murdered and cut into 12 pieces so that the pieces can be sent to the tribes.
That's pretty disturbing, Ray. But still, I mean, Exodus, think about Exodus. That was used by abolitionists as part of their argument against slavery. Think of Martin Luther King's mountaintop speech.
Yeah, sure. But you look ahead a few books in the Bible and you're going to find servants, obey your masters. People drew on that kind of thing for centuries when they wanted to justify slavery. Heck, the Bible even has some of the earliest accounts of a genocide, with God telling the Israelites to murder every Amalekite man, woman, and child, even the sheep, cows, and donkeys.
Okay, so maybe it's a mix, like Bertrand Russell said. I mean, Russell has that whole essay called Why I'm Not a Christian, and he's really not a fan of some things, like hell, for example. But even he admits that turning the other cheek, that's pretty great.
Yeah, he was a pacifist.
Yeah, and giving to the poor and not judging lest ye be judged.
Yeah, the point isn't that Christianity is necessarily terrible in every way. The point is that maybe the state shouldn't impose it on everyone.
One person who thinks that is Chaz Stevens. Let's hear why he's petitioning to have the Bible banned from 63 Florida school districts.
It's like the Republicans asked the library to go on a diet, and they went through and they took everything else except the box of Krispy Kremes. And if you're going on a diet, take the box of Krispy Kremes. That's the first one. So you really don't have to look very far in the Bible to say, holy crap, are we teaching our kids that? Cannibalism, bestiality, murder, rape, incest. My favorite, Psalm 137:9, smashing babies against the rocks. Turn a page and find something that'll make your eyes go all bonkers.
Yeah, it seems right that if you don't want children reading about, like, murder and sex and cruelty and violence, you probably shouldn't give them the Bible. And I think, like, I could take two morals from this, right? I could think, look, I shouldn't control at all what kids are allowed to read. Or you could think, like, I should control what kids are allowed to read, and one of the things I shouldn't give them is the Bible. Do you have a stance on which of those answers is right?
Absolutely. Banning Bibles, banning books, burning books, absolutely ridiculous. However, they say that the Bible book of fiction is parables. And there's some good stories in there, but there's some not good stories in there. So if you want to find ethics, do you find ethics for some Bronze Age guys that couldn't work their way out of the desert? Or do you, what about Kantian ethics, right? The Golden Rule and all that other good stuff. So it's just really, it's bizarre. Welcome to Florida. It's bizarre.
Well, you know, you're in good company because, you know, Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, had an essay called Why I'm Not a Christian, where he made some similar arguments. He said, look, there's some things I really like in the New Testament, you know, turn the other cheek, don't judge people, give away your goods to the poor. But he said the whole notion of an afterlife of eternal punishments, he said that's a doctrine of cruelty. And so for him, it's a kind of a mixed bag where, you know, you might get some good lessons for life out of it, but if you're not careful, you might be steered on a kind of dangerous path. But the thing I love most about what you're doing to your campaign is really exposing hypocrisy.
Indeed. My education, my undergrad and graduate degrees in mathematics. So I have a track record back in the day of empowering hypocrisy. In the state of Florida, I watched the local city commission meeting have an invocation, and they said the word Jesus Christ 23 times in 2 minutes. And I thought, listen, I'm just there to get my doc approved. I'm not here in Sunday school. So I had this little campaign called Satan or Silence, 14th Amendment. You got to let me go in, guys, you know, as a Satanist. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in any of that stuff. And five local cities here in South Florida, in Broward County, one in Palm Beach, said, no, we're just going to, you know, take our ball and go home. Okay, so that's the same thing with this Bible thing. I expect to lose. I expect to be told 63 times to take off in all sorts of different ways. But I hope that they give me a fair shake. I think in Broward County, I got a little carried away in Broward County. Not only did I ask for the Bible to be rejected, I also asked for the dictionary, the Oxford English Dictionary, to be rejected. I asked for the top 10 Fox News Channel books. And then I thought to myself, because I'm a nerd, I'm in IT, right? And I have friends that are school teachers, and I think the world of them. I spent a lot of time in college. I said to them, so is there such thing as a library these days? And they said, no, not really. There's some books, and there's some old beat up computers that we had, desktops that the kids beat up over the years. But what the school provides is online access. And there's carts that go around with laptops and grab the laptop and then Google your way to do that. Well, I guarantee you, little Jimmy in 11th grade isn't able to go see the latest Jugs magazine on the school laptop. And the same way that if they're going to prevent kids from seeing pornography, they need to see, if they agree that the Bible is horrible, they need to block access to that. That's what I'm shooting for. It's not actually the physical book, because there's probably not going to be a Bible in the local here in Deerfield Beach library, but there's going to be online access to that. And if they can block Playboy magazine, they can block the Bible. They can block the dictionary.
I love this device of asking to ban the dictionary, because I think it exposes this, like, really common way of thinking that, like, if there is information about an unpleasant or horrifying thing that happened, children shouldn't be exposed to it. And I think that you see this in, like, a lot of attempts to ban, like, so-called critical race theory seem like attempts to ban talking about horrible racist things that have happened in the US. And that seems kind of wrongheaded, that, like, if a bad thing happened, you shouldn't talk about that. Is that, like, informing your approach at all here?
when I came up with artwork, I have this artwork, it's called Not in the Bible. I'm an artist. It's beautiful. It's literally, and I imagine what a smash baby against the rock is, Psalm 137:9. So I did this artwork and I was lambasted, ankle bit by the Christians, saying that I took that out of context. Smashing babies, you know, happy is he who smashes babies against the rocks. I took that whole thing out of context because of it was the Babylonians raising up against somebody or other.
Right.
Okay, I am currently suing the state of Florida. The Rotunda, you guys might not know, I was the fellow that put up the Festivus poll, the Gay Pride Festivus poll, and the PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon Festivus poll back in 2013. Rick Scott, governor at the time, Skeletor, he pinched my First Amendment rights. He wanted to shut me down. This past December, I put up Fauci Clause. I'm vaxxed, I'm boosted, I take care of my elderly parents. So it was a standee of Fauci dressed up like Don Draper from Mad Men in this red Santa's outfit, which I sent him one, 6 foot tall standee. And next to him was Tucker Carlson as the Grim Reaper. Boy, that didn't go over well. I've had artwork about gay Vader, Dad Hates Ron, which is Buddy Christ holding up a sign that says, I hate Ron, blue truck balls, Ron DeSantis as a macho cop on the front of Playboy magazine. These are 24 by 36 paintings that I've done. All said no. So I'm suing, not only am I, you know, trying to get rid of the Bible, trying to get rid of the dictionary, trying to get rid of Tucker Carlson and his books, I'm also suing the state of Florida. So apparently I have a good hobby.
Your hobby is a hilarious one, but of course it has this serious point, which is, let's be fair, right? I mean, either we don't have any religion in the public square, right, in front of courthouses and so on, state houses and so on, or, you know, it's open to any religion that wants to be there. That's a principle of fairness. It goes back to the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment, and it applies to books, right, in school libraries. If you're going to ban one book, like Spiegelman's Mouse, for having a completely harmless drawing that in context has to be understood as not in any way provocative, well, then you should ban the Bible. If you're not going to ban the Bible, you're going to need to keep Spiegelman's Mass in the school libraries. Am I about right? That's where you are, Chaz?
You're spot on, spot on. It's the 14th Amendment, equal due process under the law, right? My formula is really easy. I've perfected after a decade. As Winston Churchill says, Americans do everything wrong and eventually they'll do the right thing. So after 10 years, I finally figured out what it is. It's you figure out what the hypocrisy is. You figure out what the bureaucratic hypocrisy is. And then you flip the script 180 degrees. And then you use the weight of bureaucracy against itself. I don't have to do anything. I literally said ban the Bible, and the Washington Post is calling me the next day. So if anybody wants to get off their, you know, tush and into the game, figure out what the hypocrisy is, figure out the bureaucracy behind it, and just flip the script 180 degrees, and boom, you're in the game. You're doing a Chaz. Congratulations. Welcome aboard.
I love the idea of using hypocritical bureaucracy against itself, and I think that's a great note to end on. Chaz, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys, for having me.
And I remember Florida, the land of endless mall.
Florida activist Chaz Stevens on his crusade to get the Bible banned from his state schools.
You can find all the books we've talked about on today's show, along with other recommendations from our listeners, over at our website, philosophytalk.org.
But if you just want the Cliff Notes version, there's always Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, summer reading lists usually include biographies if they aren't too long. Autobiographies preferred because they're chipper and anecdotal and the subject doesn't die at the end. We like history, if it's obscure or uplifting, or both. Like how well Lincoln got along with everybody who hated him, or the secret woman who invented a missile guidance system. You can't go wrong with thrillers. You're supposed to take those to the beach for some reason. Nowadays, I'd worry about the book catching fire. Also, thrillers seem more branded than they used to be. I guess we always had the Nancy Drews and James Bonds and Reachers, but thriller writer James Patterson, for example, offers online classes. Modern readers can teach themselves to write thrillers, just like the other thrillers, saving a bundle at the airport newsstand. Pay yourself to read it. Hope your flight's on time. Point being, maybe it's time to disrupt the summer reading list tradition. Any venture capitalist wants to give me money to do that. I can give you a white paper and a timeline with earmarks before your $1,000 pen even touches the checkbook. PM me, DM me, text me. Point being, reading lists today face many challenges. I can pretty much guarantee that nobody has made their way through the wall of tell-all books that slid out of the Trump White House. We must get on that, first things first. And if Trump goes on trial for treason, or is re-elected president, both not outside the realm of possibility, we may want to surrender full-time to the reality television metaverse and reject literacy altogether. In the meantime, Books are being slid into the flames on a daily basis, figuratively. Books used to be burned out of heresy or racism, but today we save on matches and just take them off the shelf. And reasons vary. They may trigger some of us, usually through the injudicious use of pronouns, even though conservatives say, get over it, Snowflake, you're too sensitive. Conservatives only want to take books off the shelf if gay people are mentioned. To be both sidesist about it, clearly cancel culture is a one-way, two-way street. Young adult authors cancel each other all the time. Fantasy, sci-fi, horror, most genres are heavily watched these days over diversity issues, cultural appropriation, sexism, you name it, leaving us with the same old claptrap that gave us the cancel parade in the first place. As consolation prizes, we have the Avengers, Star Wars, teeming with conflicted heroes, dozens of novels and movies about young people in wizard schools struggling to be diverse. Instead of fighting Indians, natives, or fanatics, heroes now lay waste to robots, clones, and evil twins from other dimensions. Mysteries are becoming pretty woke, I believe, but they remain Swedish and depressing. So, are books even worth it? Comics are still collectible. I recommend buying one as a hedge against inflation. Keep it in a bag, though. Don't read it. Are you crazy? And if you buy action figures with it, keep them in the original packaging until America's mood swings, which means we'll be looking back with nostalgia at these times, for some damn reason, making your comic even more valuable. Oh, what to read right now? Well, why not check out Bad Boy of Music, the 1945 memoir of George Ann Thiel. He was a composer, surrealist, futurist, wrote movie music, operas, worked on a missile guidance system with Hedy Lamarr. Settle down with that. Remind yourself that we once had a culture. Kind of. Well, we still have an action figure in a bag, so that's something, not cryptocurrency. If the bottom drops out of cryptocurrency, you got nothing. But if the bottom drops out of your bag, you still have a plastic minifig Elf Lord. Worthless, because it's not in the original packaging, but very, very real. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2022.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from subscribers to our online community of thinkers. Support for this episode comes from the Stanford Division of Literatures, Cultures, and Languages.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.